Welcome to Hunger for Wholeness, a podcast from the Center for Christogenesis. I'm your host, Robert Nicastro. Today, Ilya interviews philosopher Dr. Philip Goff about his work on the science of consciousness. They begin with the big question, what is consciousness? And survey different approaches taken between scientists and philosophers. They then ask, what might be gained from working more collaboratively on this interdisciplinary question?
Professor Philip Goff, we are thrilled, actually, that you're here. I have been a huge fan of yours for quite some time, so I'm really honored to be having this conversation with you. I'm a novice of consciousness, but it's an area I've been deeply interested in. I myself was trained in neuroscience and have a background in neuropharmacology. So I actually began with an interest in schizophrenia, the neural components of schizophrenia. So I've never kind of veered too far away from the brain and, you know, areas of consciousness and thought and things like this, mental functions. Well, let me begin. You know, the first book I read of yours, I see it on the bookshelf there, was Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. So can you tell our viewers a little bit of how you got into this area of consciousness studies and why it's so important to you? And why do you think it's the most important area today?
Well, thanks very much, Ilya. Thanks for the kind words and good to hear a bit about your background. I'm sure we've got a lot of commonality and things to talk about here. Yeah, I think I've been obsessed with the problem of consciousness as long as I can remember, really. I think it is one of the deepest scientific and philosophical challenges of our time, understanding how the kind of things neuroscientists like yourself talk about, the kind of complicated electrochemical signaling in the brain, how that fits together with thoughts and what we call consciousness, by which you mean your thoughts, your feelings, your experiences of color and sound and smell and taste. You know, these seem like very different things. On the one hand, brain activity. On the other hand, feelings and experiences. They seem like chalk and cheese, and yet we know they are intimately connected. The question is exactly how. But, you know, what I've been keen to press is that this isn't just a scientific problem. I think so many people think, oh, we just need to do more neuroscience, a few more brain scans, and we'll crack it. And, you know, the science is absolutely crucial. We're not going to make progress without the science. But what I've come to think we need to appreciate is that this is a philosophical as well as a scientific challenge. I think one of the reasons we're not making progress is we fail to appreciate that. Just finally, I'm glad you read my hard book. I thought you were going to say Galileo's Error, which I
really like that book, actually. Galileo's Error. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I don't often meet people other than people who have a PhD in philosophy who've read Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. That was really the academic technical book that worked out my view and my arguments. And then Galileo's Error was trying to present that in a more accessible form. But yeah, that's what I've been trying to really push, really, that we need to engage with the philosophy as well as the science.
Yeah, I think this area, to me, this is one of the most important areas of study today. And it's one of the most, if I use the word complex, it's not quite correct, because as you indicate, you know, science can, we can measure, we can observe, we can reduce everything to its component parts, the mechanisms that make those parts work. And yet, we can do all of that and have no idea what consciousness is. So, because every observation is an act of consciousness. So you just simply can't get rid of consciousness to even find out what it might be. And that is, you know, as many people going back, way back, you know, have recognized, is this kind of loop, you know, the paradoxical loop of consciousness, that we can't place our minds on the side and objectively look at that more, to look at this thing called consciousness. What is consciousness? I mean, what, in your view, I mean, you've written books, but just for our listeners, in your very just day-to-day, someone runs into you in the hall and says, Phil, what is consciousness?
Good, because I don't actually think the mystery is what consciousness is. Because I think actually it's kind of quite, I know a lot of people do put it that way, but I think it's quite straightforward what consciousness is, at least the standard way scientists and philosophers talk about it. Yeah, it's just what it's like to be you, your pleasure, your pain. You know, right now you're seeing colors, hearing sounds. This is all part of what it's like to be you right now.
Yeah.
And in a way, you know, to your consciousness is what it's like to be a human being. In a way, if you want to understand what it is, probably the best place to look is literature or cinema, you know, read James Joyce or something. But there's also scientific interests, you know. I think, as I see it, the scientific task is what kinds of brain activity go along with what kinds of conscious experience. That's a very important scientific task.
Yeah.
But that leaves open the question of why. Why does certain kind of brain activity go along with certain kinds of conscious experience? And it's at that point, I think, we have to turn to the philosophy, because there are various hypotheses philosophers have offered for how consciousness and the physical world are tied together. And the problem is they are what we call empirically equivalent, right? Which means you can't do an experiment to decide which is right, because
right.
For any scientific data, each of these theories just interprets that data in its own terms. That they can all explain the data. For any scientific data about how consciousness is correlated with brain activities, each of these philosophical theories can explain it. They have a story to explain it. But these stories are very different. So we end up with very different philosophical interpretations of the scientific data. And the only way we're going to be able to deal with that is just to do some philosophy. You know, I think we're in a period of history where in many ways, scientism is the religion of our times, that we think, you know, all questions can be answered with an experiment. Sam Harris has taken this to extreme, saying ethics should be settled with experiments. You know, I think most people think that's going too far. You know, you can't decide the ethics of abortion with an experiment.
Right.
And I think it's the same with consciousness too. The philosophy of consciousness can't be dealt with in that. As important as the science is, you know, I think really we need scientists and philosophers working together to make progress on this issue.
You know, one of the quotes that I often use is from Max Planck, and he says, you know, I regard consciousness as fundamental, and I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We can't get behind consciousness, he says. So this relationship between consciousness and matter, or consciousness and materiality, I do think, you know, I know you write about this in your works, but there's a kind of implicit, and this is among the hoi polloi, among those who are non-scientists, non-philosophers, that mind is something that's outside matter or just something we have. But, you know, here as a theologian, you know, I'm a Catholic theologian, where mind, it does not figure into really in a significant way, say, the question of God, that, you know, we kind of leave mind out and then we have all these kind of ideas about God. And so I'm very interested in the fundamental relationship between mind and matter. Can you say a little bit on, you know, what your position is here?
Good. Well, that's a really nice quote you had there from Max Planck, was it? And I think that captures one of the major positions on consciousness. I mean, here are two big philosophical rivals, right? One view is that the physical world is what comes first, and consciousness emerges from processes in the brain. That's the physicalist position. My own preferred position, which sounds a bit closer to Max Planck from what you just said, panpsychism, puts it the other way round. It's consciousness that's fundamental.
Yes.
And in fact, physical reality emerges from underlying facts about consciousness.
Yes.
These are the two big rivals. Of course, there's a third option that, well, they're both fundamental. Maybe consciousness is in the soul and the physical world is something separate. So these are the big rivals. As I say, you can't distinguish between them with an experiment. You just have to look at how plausible and coherent the explanations they offer are. And I think the panpsychist explanation actually is pretty much more worked out. we've managed to make coherent sense of how it could be. Maybe we could talk about this, how it could be that physical reality could emerge from consciousness, whereas the more conventional proposal, at least conventional these days, that consciousness emerges from physical stuff, I think we've never had any success at making sense of that. And there are good arguments that it's not actually a coherent explanatory proposal. So that's why I prefer this panpsychist view that it's, so it's like, is it matter first or consciousness first? And I think the idea that consciousness is first has just proved much more fruitful and coherent and to have explanatory power.
A number of years ago, because I've been teaching broadly in this area for a while, Michio Kaku, the Japanese physicist, had this idea. You know, one of his theories was that consciousness, we can begin to think of it in terms of quantum reality, or the way quantum physics holds out this kind of wave-particle duality. And in his view, he spoke about consciousness sort of as, and he likened it to sort of a wave-wave overlap, as if, you know, waves are overlapping and there's an exchange of information in this overlapping wave-wave-particle duality, or wave-particle duality field, or quantum field. And I thought that was, you know, just kind of, maybe metaphorically speaking, I thought that was quite interesting, because I do think there is something, and I think you're right, the coherency of consciousness and matter, panpsychism, that all matter. Now, if I can just kind of clarify that, would you say all matter is a form of consciousness, you know, kind of like the way Max Tegmark speaks about kind of a type of consciousness being matter itself? Or how would you see that relationship between consciousness and matter? So
I would say panpsychists don't necessarily think literally everything is conscious. The idea would be at the fundamental level of the physical universe, whether it's particles or fields, or as you say, waves, whatever we have at the fundamental level is really to be understood as forms of consciousness. And you might think that sounds a bit weird, because that doesn't sound like what physicists are telling us. But this was the genius of Bertrand Russell in the 1920s that contemporary panpsychists draw on. Russell pointed out, well, actually, physics is just a load of mathematical equations. It doesn't really tell us what matter is. Stephen Hawking famously said, physics doesn't tell us what breathes fire into the equations.
Right.
So the panpsychist proposal is, what underlies that mathematical structure, what breathes fire into the equations, is these very rudimentary forms of consciousness. And then in the human or animal brain, they combine, fuse, unify into more complex forms of consciousness. But it doesn't mean rocks and tables and chairs are conscious. So the panpsychists needn't think this cup is conscious, but they might think the smallest particles or fields it's made up of have some kind of conscious experience.
What breathes fire into the equations? For all the groundbreaking advancements in scientific knowledge, the quantum dynamics of matter still raise deep and challenging questions which cut across academic disciplines. Next, Ilya asks more about panpsychism and how it connects to more contemporary theological or philosophical visions. And later, does consciousness have anything to do with evolution? Support for A Hunger for Wholeness comes from the Fetzer Institute. Fetzer supports a movement of organizations that are applying spiritual solutions to society's toughest problems. Consider getting involved at Fetzer.org.
One of the people I study is the Jesuit Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, You know, he was an evolutionary biologist, paleontologist, a colleague of Julian Huxley, you know, and they both, in dialogue, posited this idea that there's a kind of a, well, Tyrd in particular, a withinness, he called it, a withinness and a withoutness, sort of a mental side, you know, and a matter side. And he spoke of matter having these kind of what he called bifacial dimensions, you know, mind and matter, consciousness and matter, withinness, withoutness. I thought it was really, it's really clever. It's really interesting because what he says is sort of what you're saying, that mind doesn't kind of just sort of erupt, you know, out of inert matter. Like we're just kind of moving along through evolution and then voila, you know, there comes the mind. It's that quarks, leptons, single cells, bacteria have some kind of proto-consciousness. By consciousness, I think awareness, experience, whether that's an exchange of information or whatever is going on there in the environment. So it's environmentally contextualized, for one thing. I think it's not existing as a single isolated monad, but it's kind of in relationship to everything else that is, you know, in a sense, part and parcel of its functioning. So that as evolution proceeds, he says, consciousness increases with material complexity, which is very, very interesting. So is that as matter begins to draw together through the mechanisms of material evolution, that we move from single cellular life to multicellular life to organs and plants, and consciousness, he says, is rising. So in that respect, I think, you know, even though it seems outrageous to think that like my cell phone might have a consciousness, you know, my case might, or the desk that I'm writing on can have any kind of consciousness. But I also think we find it outrageous because we still think, I think, at an operative level, certainly on the macro level, in terms of we're kind of Newtonian, we're kind of atomistic at the macro level, and we're sort of quantum on the micro level. And I think we don't have an ethics yet, or we don't have a sufficient context to think how a pan-cosmic reality could indeed be consistently and coherently the basis of all life from the quantum level upwards, you know. And why I think it's important, because I think it better situates the human person within the ecological whole, you know, within the wholeness of life. I think a consistent panpsychism is a better explanation for wholeness.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice quote from Russell. Was it Russell or was it Arthur Eddington who was the first person to experimentally confirm Einstein's general theory of relativity, which made Einstein an overnight celebrity? Arthur Eddington was also working on these ideas inspired by Bertrand Russell in the 1920s. And I can't remember which of them said, you know, modern science isn't Victorian idea of billiard balls bouncing around. He said it's more like what we'd find in a seance, you know, with all this very peculiar world we find in modern physics as it was then. But actually, Teilhard de Chardin is a very interesting figure. My father, as a young free-thinking Catholic, was very inspired, I think, by Teilhard de Chardin. And I talk about him a little bit in my recent book, Why, over my shoulder there, focusing on cosmic purpose and how Teilhard de Chardin was inspired by evolution, but inspired to think of sort of cosmic evolution, new forms of life and consciousness emerging. Some people think he, in a sense, predicted the internet because he thought the next stage of cosmic evolution would involve us becoming informationally connected up and new forms of life and consciousness emerging. And, you know, it's, I agree with you, actually, that pretty early on after Darwin, people like William James, for example, saw a natural affinity between evolution and panpsychism. The alternative is, okay, we've just got totally unexperiential matter evolving more and more and more and more complex. And then suddenly a miracle happens and consciousness pops up, this brand new thing. Whereas it seems perhaps more natural to think, well, no, before evolution, we've got these very simple or rudimentary forms of consciousness, and the evolution molds them into more complex forms of consciousness and self-consciousness and conscious understanding of the reality around us. So, yeah, I agree. It's a theory that helps solve this challenge of how consciousness fits into the physical world, but also fits with a lot of what we find in science and philosophy more generally.
about your more recent interest in cosmic purpose. You know, why are we here at all? I think, you know, kind of, I mean, if I think of Teilhard's notion of this notion of Omega, we're moving. So what's interesting is there does seem to be direction in evolution. You know, it doesn't seem to be, I mean, up till very recently, evolution just seemed to be a blind random chance of, you know, the way natural selection works and adaptation and gene selection for the fitness of life. But there seems to be much more going on. And here I do think new understandings of, you know, panpsychism, as well as cultural evolution, are giving us new understandings that we're oriented toward something. And that's what's really interesting. Toward what, you know? Not only like, why do we exist, but for what do we exist? And one of the things, you know, that Teilhard really speculated on was, and I'll put it in my words, you know, in a sense, it is not matter driving mind, it's mind driving matter. Like consciousness is driving materiality. And that's a very, very interesting idea. Like, you know, and do you have thoughts on that? Or you've probably written on this, consciousness driving evolution.
Absolutely. I think this does very much fit with the new book, modestly titled Why the Purpose of the Universe. And, you know, actually, I can say I agree with a lot of what you've said now, but I think 5 years ago, if you'd told me I'd be arguing there's a purpose to the universe, I wouldn't have believed you. This has been something of a journey, really. I think really two things, you know, people think, oh, look, surely science has proved we live in a meaningless, purposeless universe, especially post-Darwin. But I think two things really have nagged at me and ultimately resulted in this book. Two things that I think point to cosmic purpose. One is the fine-tuning of physics for life, the surprising discovery of recent decades that for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to be like Goldilocks porridge, just right. You know, not too big, not too strong, just right. I think we're kind of in denial about this as a society. It's not very controversial physics, and yet, A, I find not many people know about it unless you're really interested in this stuff. And I think it's in our normal ways of thinking about evidence, shaped by what we call Bayes' theorem, this looks to be evidence for some kind of cosmic goal-directedness towards life. I think people are just thinking, well, no, that's not how science is. And they're just really stuck in, they're letting cultural assumptions drive their theorizing rather than the evidence. But the other thing is thinking about the evolution of consciousness. If we were just complicated mechanisms, well, that's really the question. Why aren't we just complicated mechanisms? Natural selection just cares about behavior.
Right.
That's all that matters for survival, how things behave. And I think with the rise of AI, which you said we might get onto, and robotics, we now know you can have very complicated behavior and information processing without any kind of inner conscious life. So why aren't we complicated survival mechanisms?
Yep.
I mean, I suppose if you're a panpsychist, you could say, well, sort of everything has consciousness. But even then, we have consciousness that gives us understanding of what things are and what things mean. Why don't we just have messy, meaningless consciousness? If we'd behave the same, we'd survive just as well. So this is, it's more of a subtle argument. I think it's one of the more challenging chapters of the book. But this is another reason I think these two things, consciousness and fine-tuning, don't fit with our current scientific paradigm. And I really think, you know, we're just struggling to think, make it work, a bit like maybe when we started getting evidence that we weren't in the center of the universe.
Yeah.
And people thought, no, that's not the picture we got used to, and tried to make the evidence fit the theory we already have. I think something like that's going on now. Although I just say one more thing. It's interesting that the very influential philosopher Thomas Nagel wrote a book that in some ways was similar to mine 10 years ago, 11 years ago, Mind and Cosmos. And he got a very unfair, hostile reception.
Yeah.
Very, people saying, oh, he's lost the plot, he's lost his mind. And my book has not got anything like that reception. I don't think it's because it's a better book or I'm a better philosopher. I don't think I am. But I just think we can see there's more openness to these ideas.
I was a science major for years, so I understand, you know, and science has its own kind of, its own world. And it's the idea of science will tell all, it's the way to truth, it's the way to all knowledge. Science is the queen of everything. And the fact is, science has had to come down just a notch because of other disciplines like philosophy and cultural studies and, you know, the way consciousness studies itself has opened up just new areas of understanding. And I think, you know, several things. One, I think the scientific method is actually, I think in the face of quantum physics, I think the scientific method just needs to come down a notch. And I think we need new approaches to what science is about, what it can achieve. And so I think science has had to very slowly wake up to a bigger world, like we're not the entire story here. And that's really hard because, you know, a hardcore scientific materialist will say, are you kidding? Science definitely is the way to all knowledge, to real true knowledge. And everything else is just, you know, it can help maybe a little or it's just ridiculous, you know, especially when it comes to religious ideas. You know, these are just like far-fetched mythical stuff. So I think science itself is in a revision. I think it's undergoing kind of a conversion. You might say it's in conversion therapy of some sort. The second is when Nagel wrote his book, even 10 years, it doesn't seem like a long time, but a lot has happened in 10 years, even in terms of consciousness studies, the way philosophy itself has opened up, the way AI has challenged us to think anew about consciousness. So I do think your work comes at a very precipitous moment, you know, where panpsychism is gaining traction. It still has a lot of resistors. You know, a lot of people still take this as not really science or not really scientific. It lacks rigor and all this kind of stuff. But then I think anyone with a left brain and a right brain will realize that, you know, panpsychism actually is a much more coherent explanation of why we're here. I mean, our starting point for everything actually has to be us because we're the ones who are investigating, who study the universe, who study matter. We're the conscious beings itself. So this is something that Teilhard recognized. We are the whole evolution now on the level of self-thinking, on the level of thought. So not to recognize that data point is a serious fallacy of misplaced concreteness, to use Whitehead's term. And the third thing is, I do think there is still resistance to incorporating panpsychism too deeply because it does come very close to questions of spirituality and questions of God, right? So when we start, you know, kind of hovering in that religion territory, I think that still becomes very kind of a neuralgic issue for hardcore materialists, and they don't want to go there. So they're going to put up the fences and the walls of resistance. But it's precisely those walls we want to keep challenging, you know, because I think what panpsychism does, it's inviting us to rethink what this word God might mean, because we import a lot of baggage into that language, you know, and religion seems to have a lot of ideas that seem all wrapped up on what we're about. And I don't think that it's at all. I think panpsychism is calling both religion and science to step back and take a new look, a fresh new look at this one cosmos, this one world.
Next time, Ilya and Philip discuss more about the ineffable that is driving both religion and science. And Ilya asks Philip whether he thinks AI will ever become conscious. Be sure to tune in next week. I'm Robert Nicastro. Thanks for listening.